My name's Anthony, I'm an addict.
Hi,
I don't know if you can hear at the back. I'm just gonna allow myself to get comfortable. I've dried up already. it's really hot in here, and I'm quite anxious. And I've been anxious for all my life. I've been anxious the whole time I've been in recovery. I suffer with terrible paranoia, and I don't know who's going to come and do the chair. I feel like a schizophrenic different times. So you don't know who's going to turn up. So you've got the recovery person that will turn up, and you'll also have the illness. And the illness always wants a voice, always wants to be heard. So if I allow my fear to take me over, I'll get very accelerated, very speedy, and I'll just lose myself. And what I just need to do, I remember John Mealy always used to say, you know, the longest journey you'll ever make is 18 inches, and that's from your head down to your heart. And I've never forgot it. And I was a newcomer when I heard that, and that was one of the nuggets that I held on to. And but also in that journey, there's a silence, and I think that's where we make the connection, not when we speak. The silence in the room is what connects us, because it's really uncomfortable. It's excruciating. And you know, my stuff is, you know, the core of my being is I'm ashamed of who I am. I'm not enough. I'm flawed. I'm defective. I feel insignificant, terribly inadequate. But what I'll do is I'll overcompensate. And what I'll do is I'll have loads of masks, because I'm frightened for people to see the shame. And that rupture I've had all my life, long before I picked up. You know, using was like the liquid glue that held me together. What was a problem, you know, what it wasn't a problem, it was a solution to a problem, but then it became a problem. And you know, when I was young, I got a lot of negative messages, and the messages are, you're an idiot, you're thick, you're stupid, you'll never amount to nothing, you're just like your father. So my self-esteem weren't that great. And you know, I'm also, I didn't come in here with a blame list, it was long. And my blame list, like a lot of people, you know, I was a victim, you know, and that fueled my addiction. You know, I'm Irish Catholic, so I know right and wrong. My dad's from the Caribbean, from Barbados. My grandparents are from Venezuela. And I was born in Hammersmith and dragged up in South London, so I had some issues. And I think the issue that I had, that I heard, what most people have, is that sense of not belonging, not fitting in and being part of something. I felt very alienated as a child, very excluded. I'd go to school. I was born in 1960, and when I went to school, people used to spit at me. They used to call me very derogatory names. They used to spit at my mum. And I was really angry as a child. And I saw my first psychiatrist at the age of 8, because one, I didn't want my family. I wanted to get rid of them, actually murder them. But I also wanted to murder everybody else. And it was quite sad, really, because I couldn't express my feelings. I didn't have the vocabulary. I wasn't articulate. I was a child of delinquent. I was very disruptive. I caused absolute mayhem. So I've come here to Narcotics Anonymous, and I've got a voice. Because the rules in my house are, don't think, don't feel, don't trust, don't be vulnerable, don't get close to anyone, don't be intimate, because people will abuse you. They will let you down disappointed, and they will take advantage of you. So I didn't come in here brimming with love, honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. I came in here raging. I came in here for quite a number of years, still using, but I didn't want to surrender. I couldn't surrender. And it's a wonderful thing. Now, you've got to picture this, you know, that thing of being in the gutter. I've got two black bags. I'm living in a squat. You know, people are using heroin and crack in the squat. I've got nowhere to go. But I've come in here with a PhD in judgmentalism. I'm in the gutter, and I'm looking down my nose at people. The people that can save my life, I'm looking down my nose at them. And it's a wonderful thing, that thing, you know, if you think you're less than everybody else, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. If you think you're better than everybody else, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. It's an equal opportunities disease, and it doesn't discriminate. And I love that tradition free, regardless of race, colour, creed, religion, or lack of religion. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop using. I had to go and look the word up. It's a strong willing of want. You've got to want it. I was beaten, and I wanted it. But I was broken into loads of little pieces. But the funny thing is, when you come in, you've got no sense of self, no sense of identity. It was like, there was all these pieces on the floor like a jigsaw. And it was like I'd pick a piece of that person, I'd try to put myself together, and it didn't work, because it wasn't who I am, I wasn't authentic. But it was great, you know, it was great sound bites. And what I've learned over the years is to become who I am, that I'm a child of God, that I'm enough. God doesn't make junk. But what happens is my mind became corrupt, and then I started criticising, condemning and berating myself. You know, I learned new words, lambast, you know, lambast. I had to get a dictionary when I come here and a thesaurus, and I had to ask people what the hell, I'm just going to swear there, what the hell they were talking about. It's been a journey. Because my self-doubt, my self-ideal and my self-concept of myself is that I can't communicate. And then somebody said you can. You can read into yourself and you can express yourself with words. And it's a way of reading and writing. I didn't know that, but someone framed it for me. They reframed something for me that made sense. And it gave me a bit of confidence. Because people, you know, I was traumatised as a child with regards to having any feelings. If I had any feelings, I got beaten. So you learn to be quite numb. And you can also be abused by people in the rooms when you're having a feeling, because they haven't had a feeling themselves. They don't want you to go there. You know, it's, as sad as that is, that's my truth. It might not be yours. And also the other thing is, you'll hear what you want to hear tonight. What goes in one ear, by the time it comes out the other ear, might be something different to what I said. And the reason why I said that, I've had people share back to me, and it's not what I shared. And I'm okay with that, because I had the yeah but, and I know, yeah but. I knew everything when I came here, but I didn't know about recovery. And that's the process. The process for me is, I violated my body. At the end of my using, I felt like another obscenity. I wanted to be put out of my misery and just discarded and left somewhere to die. I felt absolutely worthless. I've relinquished my responsibilities as a man, as a father, as a son, as a husband, as a colleague, as a friend. I gave it all up because I was a slave. I was a slave to any chemical I could put in my body. I started with opiates, but I wound up on crack. And it sent me cuckoo for Cocoa Pops. You know, at the age of 16, I used to sit in a flat, and these guys used to go out, rob the chemists, rob the DDA cabinet, and whatever came back, we used. I didn't care what I put in my body. My body had no value. It was worthless. It was a piece of shit. It was something just to be abused. And what I see in recovery is, you know, that was all about self-hatred. I hated myself. And what recovery is about, it's about self-love. But it's also about why we come here tonight, you know. And sometimes it's to be informed, it's to be inspired, it's to be motivated. You know, sometimes I forget this is a place of sanctuary. I come here to feed my spirit. I need to nourish my soul, and I do that with words. A man can't live on bread alone. He needs words. My spirit needs to be fed. And I've done a lot of work. The work is continuous. I had a wonderful thing. I've just been in California as well, and I had a wonderful thing out there. If your addiction didn't kill you, your defects of character will. You know, because it'll just finish off the job. And I've come in here with my illness. My illness didn't say, you go into recovery and I'll see you when you get out. It came in here with me. And it looks like me, it sounds like me, it's my voice. And people say my disease is outside of me. It's not. It's me. I have to distinguish which one's in the driving seat. My disease hasn't gone nowhere. It ain't doing press-ups. My disease is me. But what I'll do is I'll justify my behaviour. I'll say that was my disease. If you go to court and you'll stand up in front of the judge, you go, it weren't me, it was my disease. You know, find out how much you're going to get sentenced, you're going to get it. You know, it's not a good enough excuse. And I blame anything. I blame the drugs, I blame my mum, blame my colour, blame the trauma. You know, as a child, I was traumatised. I had most bones broken in my body by men at different times. I've been traumatised in many different ways, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, academically, sexually. I've been traumatised. So I haven't just come in here with an addiction. I come in here with some issues. I'm dealing them one at a time. I like that, one at a time. My first sponsor said a wonderful thing to me, and it was really helpful. He said, if you're going to eat a whale, how are you going to eat the whale? And the way to eat in a whale is not all in one go, it's to cut it into millions of little pieces and eat it one piece at a time. And it's the best bit of advice I've ever been given, because that's what I've had to do. Is I've come here, I came here in 1994. I came for 18 months. I didn't get clean. I came every day and I used. And I went to the meeting in Clapham and I heard someone say another nugget. He said, what you put in is what you get out. And I got it. And whatever you put into recovery is what you get out and more. And for me, that really helped. But the thing that really helped me to keep coming back and stay, because it's really important to stay, was get smart feet. I had this really posh woman. And I know a lot of people think it's Mary Pugh, 12-step, and it's not. What it was, this really posh woman. I mean, her nose was so far in the air, it was unbelievable. She looked at me with disdain and disgust and utter contempt. But what she did is she carried a message to me. And the message was, get smart feet. Get your body to meetings and then your mind will follow. I thought, wow, profound. That's a sentence, I can hold on to that, it was enough. And that's all I've done, is I've come to meetings for 20 years. And I've stayed clean since 1995. And meetings aren't enough, I just need to say that, they're great. Don't get me wrong. Because my journey is different from a lot of people. I got clean, I thought I've got to swerve this, I've got a couple of Crown Court cases, I'm going away for a conspiracy to defraud the clearing bank, obtaining money by deception, theft, dangerous driving, reckless driving after coming out of the bank and being chased all over Kent and Knightsbridge. You know, all the normal stuff, you know, to get into use, you've got to get money, you know, you've got a habit, you've got to pay for it. And people used to ask me, what do you do? I said, I'm in banking. I didn't say I was in other people's banking, but, you know, I used to come to meetings and they used to call me suited and booted Tony because I was still going to graft. You know, when I first came there, I was still going to graft. You know, I was sitting in the Mona Lisa buying everyone lunch and dinner. I was going, oh, I'll get it, don't worry about it. Someone else's credit card. You know, it was mad. I was mad. I was bonkers. But that thing of just keep coming back was when I got clean, after 35 days of being clean, I got a sponsor. So all the lies that I've told myself all my life, I had to challenge. And that was around men. Because my experience of men is either they want to smash the life out of you or they want to have sex with you. So I had to go against the grain and try something different. And my sponsor was a good man, very nurturing, very loving, very kind, very gentle. He didn't tell me what to do. Because I was a very troubled individual, I was going to say very angry. I was very disturbed. Oh, I've got a cramp in my leg. He was very gentle. And what he did is, he made suggestions. And I know Mickey's down the back. And one of the things, Mickey says, there ain't any other suggestions in the book. People go, there are only suggestions, but there ain't no other suggestions. And that's true. And the suggestions he made was, there was like that sliding door. He'd give me two options. If you go down that door, that's what will happen. If you go down that door, that's what will happen. So what he did is he gave me the choice. And a lot of the time I'd go down the door that was very, very destructive and very painful, but he allowed me to have my pain, because in having my pain, that's where I grew. That's how I become the person that I am today. I'm the man that I am today through pain. It's been the fertilizer for growth. I don't get in the way of people's pain or their recovery. It's really important to have pain because it brings about change. My step one, you know, I was terrified writing it, but I wrote it. And what I learned about was spiritual principles. Where I come from is a place of dishonesty. And the first spiritual principle is honesty. And it also talked the six spiritual principles in step one. And one of them is humility, acceptance and surrender. And it's really important to accept that I have an illness that I'll have for the rest of my life. And I also have to have the humility to be teachable. Because when I admit my ignorance, I become teachable. When I'm arrogant, I'm not teachable. And that was so important, to admit my ignorance, because then I could learn. And what I've done is I've just continually learned the whole time I've been here. I've gone through the steps on numerous occasions, but step one is the foundation of my recovery. And that surrender, I have to surrender every day. What I did yesterday for my recovery won't keep me clean today. You know, I'm going to quote Mahatma Gandhi, and what Mahatma Gandhi says, each night I go to bed, I die, but each morning I wake up reborn. And that is my recovery, because I mess up. I need to say that. I'm not sorted. You know, I'm 20 years clean in 6 weeks. I am not recovered. I'm not sorted. I haven't arrived. It's ongoing. You know, because life happens, and with life comes great difficulties and great stress and great pain, but also great joy and great fun, great things happen in life. You know, one of the things that's happened to me recently, you know, I would talk about the honesty, open-mindedness and willingness, which are fundamental throughout all the steps, from steps 1 to 3, from 4 to 6, from 6 to 9, to 10 to 12. The honesty and open-mindedness are the spiritual principles that are in all those steps all the way through, and then other spiritual principles get added on top of them. Just going to come up to the present, just having a look at the time. You know, this year I got very ill. I was really angry. I was really angry. You know, I got diagnosed with pulmonary embolism. I had blood clots all over my lungs. And also I've got adrenal gland deficiency. My body's not got no cortisone. And it's been a really difficult year because, you know, 6 to 8 months ago I couldn't walk 10 yards. I couldn't breathe. And I was really scared. And I prayed to God. I said, please don't let me die. I've got unfinished business. I need to sort out, you know, my life insurance, my pension and all that for my kids. I've got responsibilities. But I used to be scared to go to sleep at the night time because I thought, I'm not going to wake up. I'm not getting enough oxygen around my body. I can't breathe. And I spent a bit of time in hospital, in and out of hospital. And, you know, I let go of a few people that were my friends. And what I've come to accept now, you know, I've allowed them back into my life at that particular time. They couldn't handle it. Because I've been this, you know, I've put myself up as this tower of strength. But in reality is, I'm a human being. I bleed, I cry, I have liabilities, I have limitations. I also have assets, but I'm just a human being. And, you know, I can't escape death. But what I can do is live life by applying these principles to my life. You know, I'm looking at the time, so I like to go through all the steps, but I haven't got time. You know, I've waited 3 years to speak here. Let's put that one on the list. Last time I spoke here was February 2013. It's all right, and I've come regular since it opened. It's all right. I think I need to talk about the fourth step. You know, the steps 1, 2, and 3 is the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. But that step 3 is about the second surrender and about making a commitment. It's so important to make a commitment. You know, recovery is like a marriage. It's a love-hate relationship, but you stay in it no matter what. No matter what. No matter what happens, I'm here. And my step 4 changed my life. It transformed me to the person I am today. I hated myself. I hated my mum. I hated my dad. I hated the absolute world. And what I've got now is I've got a lot of love for myself, a lot more compassion and a lot more forgiveness, a lot more understanding and nurturing for myself that I don't hate myself. But I don't hate my mum either. Because in doing the fourth step, what I realise is I've got unrealistic expectations of a lot of people and I set them up to fail. People are human beings. So if you came here this evening and you wanted to hear what you wanted to hear, part of your self-centeredness is, I'm going to let you down and I'm going to disappoint you. And you're going to cop a lovely resentment and you're going to go home with it. Enjoy. It's your resentment, it's not mine. I'm going to have a lovely sleep. But I looked up the word resentment, you know, because it's really important. You know, I like looking up words. You know, I'm at university at the moment, I'm a mature student, but I've always loved looking up words because I don't understand them. And a resentment is a sickness of the soul. It's something that poisons the soul, poisons the spirit. It contaminates and corrodes and corrupts and permeates through the body like a cancer. And that's what resentment is. Powerful. But the resentment takes more people out the door than anything else. You know, we talk about love. Let's talk about resentment, because it also opens up the door on all the character defects. The main one being hatred, anger, envy, jealousy, pride, ego, lust, fear, self-centeredness. It opens up the door on them. But when you get to that place of hatred, because you resent someone that badly, the poison just, you know, you become rancid, you become sick. And if you ain't treating your illness will take you out the door. And one of the primary things the illness does is it looks for all the differences. It separates us. Because what it wants is it wants you on your own. Because the propaganda machine is between your two ears. It's not outside of you. I always thought the enemy was outside of me. I'm living with the enemy. The enemy is me. It ain't nobody else. I live with the enemy. I live with my illness or my disease or whatever you want to call it. And what it wants to do is it wants me to sit indoors and listen to the volume in my head telling me why not to come to meetings, why not to read the literature, why not to sponsor people, to be of service, to be of help to anybody? You know, because I didn't come in here brimming with love, honesty, minus willingness. I came in here a habitual criminal. You know, in giving, they said, in giving one receives. You know, who worked that one out? You know, in giving you receive. But that's the reality. You know, that passing some, oh, we do it. We've all got different deliveries. You know, I've just been in California. They smashed the book over your head. You know, they ain't listening to the illness. You know, they will attack the illness. It's full on. It's mainly speaker meetings. There's no participation, but there's fellowship afterwards and there's participation meetings in the daytime. But it's fantastic. But what I understand is, you know, we've all got the same disease. Its primary purpose is to manoeuvre us in a place where we've got no defence against it, so as that we use. And when I use, I become a heathen. My morals go out the window. I have no values, no morals, and I relinquish all those responsibilities of being the man that I've become in recovery. I just revert back to who I was. Worthless piece of shit. So what this does is, this gives me a sense of completeness and wholeness. It's take, you know, and that's the thing, that step four also talks about assets, which people, it, and this is the key thing that people forget. At step three, it says, we are now ready for our first honest self-appraisal. Look up the word appraisal. It talks about assets, liabilities, limitations. It doesn't just talk about defects of character. It's about seeing the whole person. But we like to see ourselves as something flawed and negative. Because what we can do is we can feed it. You know, I used to do chairs and it was like I had to justify my existence to do a chair. And I just have to be who I am. Enough. I think one of the things that I learned at my step four is that, you know, because I'm not enough, I'm a chronic people pleaser. And I used to love that thing. You know, people used to ask me to do things and I was a real yes person. But this is what had happened. Just watch my hands. And if you can't see at the back, I'll try and explain it as best as I can. My hands are on my stomach. They're moving up. You know, they're on my solar plexus. They're on my chest. They're on my neck. They're on my thing. But I'm saying, no, 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 the whole time. And then what comes out of my mouth is yes. But behind the yes is a resentment. Now it's loaded. Now it's got me. Because I've said yes. Because I didn't have the ability to have any boundaries and say, can I go away and think about that, or talk to my sponsor, or think that through. And I didn't realise I was dishonest. Because, you know, I wanted people to like me. I didn't want to be rejected. When you sit in a room with about 50 to 70 people, I don't know how many people's in here, you've got the chance of 70 people rejecting you. So what it taps into is social shame. So we do a lot to cover up the social shame. You know, recovery is amazing, and I think the amazing thing about that fourth step is, you know, I grew up because I learned to have a relationship with myself. I could look in the mirror and not despise myself. I've got two beautiful children in recovery. You know, my other children are quite old. There was a lot of neglect, a lot of abandonment, a lot of desertion, a lot of rejection. I said I didn't want to be my dad or my mum, and what I realised when I wrote my fourth step, I was a chip off the old block. If you spot it, you got it. If you're pointing a finger at anyone for anything, take a look at yourself. Because what I found is I got humiliated further along down the line after I took someone's inventory. Because the things they were doing, I wound up doing myself. And that's the gift of recovery. You know, we get to see who we really are. And it's absolutely amazing. You know, I was caught up in fear. I got five minutes. I need to talk about fear. You know, I this week I felt ill, and this is where my head goes. I felt ill, chest pains, crushing chest pains. So I've got an heart attack. You know, my head's already told me you're going. It's over, and it goes straight to death. I've got an heart attack. It's been going on for 10 days. Now I need to go to the hospital and check it out. Now I think the clots have come back on my lungs because it was the same symptoms as before. Stabbing chest pains, can't breathe, really nervous, terrible anxiety, I'm frightened. So someone's challenged me around it, and I've gone to the hospital and it turned out to be muscular, but my head just went to work on me. And all it was fear. My imagination, what happens in that dark space in your head is your imagination has a field day with you. It's okay to have fear. You know, you don't want to step out in front of a car. You don't want to jump off a roof, or, you know, or go down a dark alley in South London late at night because you ain't coming out there too much after coming out of the alley. That's dangerous, you know. But we've got fear. That's imaginary, irrational. You know, I had so many fears, and I think that my biggest fear was of being loved, of being wanted, of being cared for, being nurtured. Fear of intimacy and closeness. You know, fear of abandonment. I've got loads of fears around violence and all that other stuff, but the real deep core is my biggest fear is of being abandoned or being ridiculed. I think my biggest fear when I used to do chairs was that I'm going to be totally humiliated and ridiculed while I do this, and it doesn't really matter. Most people are self-obsessed. You know, someone else will come here and do a chair next week. You know, and people forget what you said. You know, I've done it. You know, someone smashed the book over my head. It was fantastic. And I didn't know what they said afterwards because I had headache. Fantastic chair, but I had headache. Can't remember. Oh, I've got cramp again. Glad this is finishing. Ah. Oh. I've just got to stretch my legs. Come on. I'm just going to finish on one thing. I've got 3 minutes, you know, and I always have a bit of literature just in case I'll dry up. I haven't dried up, but I like to finish on this because I've got the cramp and I need to stand up and I'm in a lot of pain. And I'm also a masochist. Oh, this way I can get out of it. Okay. I was going to read about The Journey Continues, Having a Spiritual Awakening. I'm going to read that and then I'm going to shut up. And it just says, a spiritual awakening is just that, an awakening. We still have to get out of bed. Some people awaken just a moment and then doze off again. If we want to stay awake and alive, if we want the miracle of recovery to continue to unfold in our lives, we find ways to put this awakening into action. If we're not carrying the message, we go to sleep again. Thanks for letting me share.